Welcome to Hedge Fund Tips with Tom Hayes. I'm Tom Hayes, and this is your 230th video cast podcast for the week ending March 14th, 2024. We're live from London this week. I got a lot of exciting stuff to cover, tremendous amount of detailed information this week, so we're going to get right to it. First, the family updates. That's Mimi's yearbook photo for Laurel Springs for the sports edition in her water polo uniform. That's me out in front of the hotel. It's interesting. They have these five Ferraris parked in front, and I got in from the overnight flight, which was, by the way, interesting. Let me just give you a tip. Take your cell phone out of your pocket before you lay the seat back flat, because if it falls out while you're sleeping, you can't get it out. They literally had to have an engineer come on the plane and like undo the seat to get my phone. But leaving that aside, so I'm like, man, like, does everyone drive their Ferrari to breakfast in London? But sure enough, I went down to Jerome Street to get some clothes. And when I came back, all these cars were still here. So either these are the longest business breakfasts in the history of mankind, or the hotel just keeps them parked there on purpose. I think it's the latter. So, but nonetheless, nice touch. Some pictures walking to and from. That's my mom came up to the house last week with Mimi and Annabelle. This is interesting. This was a block away from the hotel, Lotus dealership. I love Lotus. I had a Lotus Elise like, gosh, it must be like 13 years ago, 15 years ago. Most fun I've ever had in a car. Oh, well, I've got another one that I have more fun in. But this one, I don't point this one out because it's like amazing or anything. They're better, trust me, than that. However, this just came out and you can still get it in a manual transmission. And in my world, no matter how awesome the other cars are, there's nothing like a manual. And to be able to get this Amira with a manual is pretty darn interesting. And for those of you, half of you who don't know what a manual transmission is, I am seriously sorry for you. There's absolutely nothing like it. Paddles are fun, but it's nice to see a few companies have figured out that people still want that. And it was nice to see that in the showroom a block away. This is from Tuesday at the New York Stock Exchange. That's the CNBC booth with Scott Wapner in the background there. I was there to do Schwab. That's the old City Hall by the NYSE. That's me right before I went on with Nicole Petalides. And that's outside. If you're ever in New York, you got to do it. That's the heart of capitalism. Unbelievable. Just thought I'd share some of that with you. That's the Schwab booth right there. And moving right along. So on Jerome Street, which is where all the tailors are, most of you Europeans already know that, but the Americans don't. And so we went to, so I wanted to get some handmade English shoes. I went to, and I asked around, and they said, you got to go to Crockett and Jones. So I tried on, you know, a bunch. Go see Thomas on Jerome Street. He was so patient with me. I was looking for one particular thing, and he was able to get it. And then over at Harvey and Hudson, my jacket got stained on the earlier this week, and so I needed a new jacket. And go and see Matthew, which is amazing because they had this beautiful jacket that I wanted. And I was like, you know, the sleeves are a hair short here. He's like, well, we can tailor that for you. I said, look, I'm only in town for 2 days. There's no way you can tailor it. He's like, how's 5 o'clock? I was like, bring it to my hotel. He's like, done. They had it here literally in 2 hours, perfectly tailored. That is amazing. So if you're in the market for shoes, go see Thomas at Crockett and Jones. If you're in for jackets, shirts, suits, Matthew at Harvey and Hudson. I mean, Harvey and Hudson's been around for 70 years. Crockett and Jones, 130 years. I mean, the history of these places is phenomenal. Was on with Nicole Petalides. Want to thank her and Caitlin Christ on Schwab Network. This was a great overview and some stocks that we're obviously in, and outlook and some nuanced ways to think about it. So we're going to play this clip.
And joining me right now, Thomas J. Hayes is here, chairman and managing member, Great Hill Capital LLC. Glad you are here. So you watched that inflation report today. You know, and you're watching whether or not the Fed may or may not cut. Your thoughts?
Well, I've been walking around the floor here. I can't find a bear anywhere. It's mind-boggling. You know, all the same people who were bearish the whole way up, and we've been publicly very bullish the last year and a half. And I got to tell you, Nicole, this is the first time the last week and a half, we started to put portfolio hedges on. We are fully invested long, but we've allocated 2% of equity capital to hedge out our portfolio, put spreads on the S&P 500, put spreads on the semiconductor index. And the interesting thing about this morning is it was hotter than expected across the board, except for month-on-month headline inflation. And yet the expectations for cuts in June barely moved, still 70% expectation of a cut in June.
What might we have seen? I mean, what do you think that the Fed, because of all this that, you know, we wait for the PCE too, right?
Yeah. So the PCE is what they're looking for. We also saw on Friday average hourly earnings came down. Mm-hmm. You know, generally things are humming along. Earnings expectations for this quarter went now with 99% of the components having reported. Up 3.4% earnings growth versus estimates they were expecting 1% earnings growth.
Right.
Except we're trading at 21 times forward. So we're getting a hair rich, and I want a little bit of protection even though we remain fully invested.
Understood. So you said maybe you're expecting a pullback to the tune of what, 3 to 8%, you said?
I think that would be a reasonable range. And if you look in election years, number one, since 1928, on average, they're up 11.28%. So we're very constructive for the year.
Right.
But this period of late February through mid-April tends to be a period of seasonal weakness on average for the last 50 plus years. This would be a good time to take a breather, especially, you know, with the S&P up 28% since October.
Sure.
Semiconductors 68% since October. That's a big run in a short amount of time.
It's pretty amazing, really, when you think about the run, because I'm not sure everybody expected it, right? You had a terrible year and then things started to come back. And at this point now, if we do see these pullbacks, 3 to 8%, would you be buying on dips? Like, at what point would you say, I'll buy?
Yeah, there's no question about it. We are not having a problem putting money to work. There still are values in the market to go long. As far as buying the general indices, we think they've gotten a little bit ahead of themselves. Some subsectors like semis may be a little bit ahead of themselves.
Yeah.
But there are values. You're seeing a greater broadening in the stock market. Of more sectors participating. We think there are opportunities in small caps. We think there are opportunities in mid caps. But one of the companies that we really like that we've owned for a little bit here is Stanley Black & Decker. How boring can you get? They've got tools, okay? They've got Stanley, they've got Craftsman, they've got Black & Decker, they've got DeWalt. And they over-inventoried during COVID. They bought a lot of inventory when they thought they couldn't get it. They've worked through that over the last six, seven quarters. They're now inflecting. They're taking $2 billion out of costs out of the business. They're well ahead of schedule on that by 2025, which amounts to about $13 a share in savings. And their historical multiple is 16 times. So just on the cost savings with an average multiple, you're looking at $200 a share of value. The stock's only trading at $91. And the last time that they got their margins up to 35%, which they're also ahead of schedule on the margin recovery, they're at 30% gross margins right now. They had $8 a share in earnings, and they were trading around 153. Just on the cost savings, they're going to have more earnings than that and the multiple expansion. So we think there's a lot of upside over the next 12 to 36 months in Stanley Black & Decker. Boring stock, exciting outlook.
No, people love tools and things. It's at $90 and change. I mean, is this a $100 stock? Is this a $110 stock, maybe?
Well, it's a $90 stock now. We think it can be a double over the next 3 years. So
double over the next three years. Wow, that's a big call.
Margin expansion, huge
cuts.
It's down 55 right now, so we're looking for a reversion back up towards all-time highs, and it's going to take a little time, but they're on the right track.
That's amazing. Okay. How about Generac?
Generac, another boring one.
It's a fun one. You need a generator if there's like a wind or a tornado or some catastrophe.
Yeah. They're number one in the home standby generators. They also do commercial, 70% of the market they control. Again, everyone couldn't get parts, couldn't get supplies during COVID. They all over-ordered. They've worked through those inventories over the last six quarters. And here's what's interesting about this one. You know, Stanley Black & Decker's down 55% off its all-time highs. This one's down 70% off of its all-time highs. And last quarter, they generated record free cash flow, $266 million of free cash flow, $354 million for the year. So in a turnaround story, the number one thing you want to see is that they have free cash flow to execute the plan. Because the big thing with turnarounds when stocks fall is, are they over-leveraged? Are they going to make it? In the case of Generic, that's not the case at all. All we needed them to do is work through the inventory. And as you can see from the free cash flow and the orders and the acceleration of the business, that the worst is behind them. And this can really reaccelerate quickly now.
There's been so much talk about it, what the Fed should or shouldn't do. Even the Fed said, we don't want to cut too early. You know, we don't want to raise again if we don't need to. You know, it's sort of this catch-22. Jamie Dimon noted that the Fed shouldn't cut too fast, a warning that a recession is not off the table. So what's the final thought here? Are you worried that the Fed may make a move that they shouldn't?
I'm worried that they don't make a move that they should.
Tell me.
I think the sooner that they do the first cut, the less cuts they'll have to do. I think if they actually move on the first cut, they might only need one or two cuts like we saw in that 1995 inflection. If they wait too long and we need more than the three cuts that everyone's looking for, that could signal that we have bigger problems and they waited too long for the lagged effect.
Interesting, because that's different. I mean, there are other people who think if they cut, it means that we're seeing a lot of deterioration.
Much easier to solve inflation than deflation. If you let it go too far, the amount of cost to society to bring us back from deflation are enormous. If they go too early and inflation spikes a little bit, they can always hike again. It's not a big deal.
Right, right. Okay. Yeah. Thank you so much. It's great to see you.
Thanks,
Thomas
Nicole.
J. Hayes,
appreciate
Chairman
it.
And Managing Member, Great Hill Capital.
And we're back. So that was a general overview. And then the night before that, I was on with Karina Mitchell over at CGTN America. I know Karina for many years from Yahoo Finance. I want to thank Nancy Ali, as well as Karina, for having me on. We'll listen in here.
And for more on Bitcoin's heady surge and other market insights, we're joined by Thomas Hayes. He is the founder, chairman, and managing member of Great Hill Capital. Always good to see you, Thomas. Thank you so much for your time. So Bitcoin is on a real tear, right? The latest push driven by news from the UK. It's considering the possibility of opening the door to exchange-traded notes on an institutional level, not retail, just to be clear. How big a deal is it? And do you think it opens the door to institutions in the US picking up more confidence in the space? Outflows from Bitcoin ETFs since inception in the US have been quite sizable.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Karina. You know, there has been a lot of activity in Bitcoin as it relates to the ETF flows and more advisors starting to think about whether clients should have a 0.5% or 1%. So that's driving demand. You have the halving happening, as John had mentioned, in a few months that will limit supply. You also have the UK story. But I think the real story here, Karina, because we don't focus on Bitcoin, we focus on solid companies, productive companies with free cash flow. The real story is the market is trying to sniff out the Fed cutting. And Powell had indicated that he just needed a little bit more evidence when he was in front of Congress to begin to lower borrowing costs. So I think that's driving all risk assets. You've seen it in energy, you've seen it in equities with the S&P up 27% since late October, semiconductor index up 77% since late October. So I think a lot of this has to do with the cost of money and animal spirits coming back into the market.
Oh, we've seen some heady profits, but we're seeing a bit of a pullback now, some profit taking in the broader U.S. markets. That's after a record run in equities and bonds. That's a result of overbought conditions, some say. Is it time to hedge? Are we seeing the start of some kind of a bubble, or are we just in the middle of what could be a really, really sweet spot, particularly after Friday's pretty perfect jobs report?
Well, the answer is we don't know, Karina, but I can tell you this. We were extremely bullish since October 2022. It was very, very lonely over the last year and a half during many particular periods. And only lately in the last couple of months have you seen the people who had been bearish the entire 50% rally start to flip bullish. And that's usually a sign, not necessarily that we have to crash or anything extreme like that, but a pullback would be in order, maybe 4 to 8%. It's also normal seasonally in this period of the year during an election year between late February and mid-April to see a pullback. So despite being bullish and constructive for the year, because the average election year is up 11.28% since 1928, we did put, for the first time in a long time, two 1% equity hedges on our portfolio, one on the S&P and one on the semiconductor index. If we're wrong, we're fully invested, we're constructive and long, the rest of the portfolio will go up. If we're right, that short-term pullback will create some excess capital for us to invest into year end. So I think intermediate to long-term, very constructive. Short-term, a little bit cautious, because you got to look at earnings were good, up 3.4% when they were only expected to be up 1%. But we're trading at 20.7 times forward earnings right now. That's a little bit rich.
It is quite rich. But some analysts say there's still a lot of liquidity around, evidenced by these record markets, crypto investment as well. They believe if the Fed cuts rates, money will pour into stocks. So do you have that impression as well? If so, will it be broad-based investments or sector-specific? Any particular stock picks that you have?
Yeah, I do think that is correct, and I think it's coming a little later. You know, the big number, we saw obviously average hourly earnings come down. We saw the unemployment rate go up. That gives the Fed cover. But the big numbers are tomorrow, the core CPI and CPI, and then on Thursday, the PPI reports as well. And we're going to find out just how quick the Fed can go. We've been getting these statistical and seasonal aberrations, and the lagged effect of owner's equivalent rent has not been kicking in, so the numbers of late haven't been as good as we wanted. I think the opportunity, Karina, is going to be the heavy-weighted tech that's driven the rally is going to slow down a little bit, maybe perform less well in coming months, and then the opportunity is in those companies that have lagged. Start to look at small caps, start to look at utilities, start to look at REITs, start to look at the groups that have underperformed, now starting to participate. Industrials are starting to break out, biotech starting to break out. So there's a lot of opportunity under the surface, even if the indices stutter a little bit and then pick up in the back half of the year.
And then, as you say, fresh inflation data about to come out. What are you expecting to see in that data? And then what do you see the Fed doing? When do they pull the trigger on a rate cut?
Well, if we beat expectations, you know, they're looking for 0.4 month on month for headline, 3.1% year on year. If we see a two handle, 2.9, 2.8, that could be bullish now for the markets. I think given the recent pattern with a little bit of seasonal oddity to the numbers that won't be sustainable over coming months, but for the temporary point of view, the fake out has been the numbers have been coming in a little bit worse than estimates, and people have been getting worried. The answer is we just don't know. We're going to have to wait till tomorrow morning and find out. But if you do get a two handle on that headline, I think you're going to see some short-term buying for sure. If you come in at 3.2, people are going to get worried again, and that could in fact be a catalyst for a short-term pullback until they finally get to cuts. The key with the Fed is the sooner they start cutting, the less cuts they'll have to do. If you wait for the robins to sing, it's already spring. Sometimes waiting for too much evidence is going to be too costly. So we'll see how it plays out, and we're going to see those dot plots for what they expect to happen and some discussion about the taper this month.
So that gives you the general overview. So now we can get into more granular stuff. We'll start with our quote of the week from Warren Buffett. The most important quality for an investor is temperament, not intellect. And I wanted to add a second quote from Seth Klarman, which said the single greatest edge an investor can have is a long-term orientation. And that is joined at the hip with temperament to sit through the long-term. And we've talked about Charlie Munger's BYD investment. BYD is the electric car company in China, which he bought in literally like 2009. And he held it for 10 years. It effectively did nothing. There were three drawdowns of 50% or more. And then within 12 months, it was a 12-bagger. So a 12-bagger over 10, 12 years is not a bad IRR. And it goes to show that sooner or later, the long-term weighing machine based on fundamentals catches up with the short-term voting machine that is based on emotions and creates those erratic same business. Same everything. It's just when the market realizes it, it realizes it. And I think a better way to think about that is Munger once said that it's very difficult to have a business that compounds capital at 20% a year for over a long term that the stock doesn't do at least that over time, or 10% or whatever it happens to be. Sooner or later, that return, whether it all comes at once or it comes in a linear fashion, throughout the process, that is the game that we play.
And speaking of which, temperament and time arbitrage, just as I was going to record this, this article came into my inbox from Barron's, my favorite financial publication, this time from Ben Levinson. And Ben says, PayPal stock has fallen far enough, it's time to buy. And we're seeing the stock obviously start to make good headwinds. Here, it broke above, I think it's 50-day or something. I see all these people on Twitter with their squiggly lines getting all excited. And, you know, that stuff is secondary. What's primary is price is what you pay, value is what you get. And the price that we're paying relative to value is one of those instances that comes around several times in a career. So yeah, you can see how it's now breaking above this 50-day moving average or 200-day moving average. So it's up from 50, it's now at 63 and starting to get going. And Barron's earlier than most. Barron is willing to stick their neck out and recommend quality stocks when they're out of favor, which is why it's the best publication in the world. What I like about this article, besides all of the things that we've covered about Alex Chriss and his initiatives and $5 billion of free cash flow and buying back 7% of the stock a year the total payment volume going up and firing the non-profitable customers and Braintree having 10% of global enterprise spend of $500 billion every time you take an Uber, every time you buy a ticket at Ticketmaster, that's all PayPal. Venmo being a verb, PayPal being a verb. You just don't have companies with all of that intellectual property, you know, trading at 11 times, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What I loved about what he said was he basically said that it's trading. Here it is. This is great. This is from David Rolt, Chief Investment Officer at Wedgewood Partners. PayPal is trading like a coal mine that has a finite life. It won't take a whole lot to get it re-rated. And that's the name of the game we've been talking about. You know, the average multiple on PayPal is like 28 times. It's trading at 11 times. We're not saying that it's necessarily going to go back to 20 or 30% growth, but it could very easily and quickly go back to 15% growth, in which case a 15 to 20 times multiple would be justified. And then you get that growth compounding with the re-rated multiple. And that's how you get doubles and double pluses and triples and so on. So other people are starting to see what we see again a little later. And then guess what, which we're going to talk about this week. It wouldn't shock me if in a couple of months we see an activist follow us into the stock, as we've seen four times in the last 12 months. Here is the trend and cycle roadmap from Schlumer over at RBC, thanks to my buddy over there, you know who you are. And this is the general indices. So you heard me talk about hedging the S&P and hedging the semiconductor now with 2% of total equity capital. And you know the beauty of this asymmetry is that if we are correct and we get a 5 to 8% pullback in these two indices, we'll actually create somewhere in the neighborhood of 14 to 15% of new capital from thin air, basically from 2% equity capital, which then we can take that 14% and go long aggressively into year end, which could create now 25 points of alpha, which is just mind boggling. If we're right. If we're wrong, we lose 2% on our hedge or our tactical short, in which case, you know, the market, we still have enough beta in the portfolio that if the market never pulls back in the next couple of months and, you know, goes up another, 7 or 8% or whatever it happens to be, you would think that we would only go up 5 because we lost the 2. But more likely than not, with the beta in the portfolio, you know, we'd be up a lot more than the 7. So yeah, we'd be up 2% less than we were. But in exchange for the possibility of creating 14, 15% of new capital
and then going into year end with that plus the portfolio and having a chance to shoot the lights out and have a monster year again, that is very interesting. And we like the asymmetry around that. And that's how we're thinking about that. So here, the NASDAQ is showing its showing signs of being tired and rolling over. That's okay. Look, I don't want to be too cute here. We have had no gains for 2 years. The indices have been consolidating the gains from 2021. So we're not bearish or anything. We just think it's a little exhausted. 18 out of 20 weeks. It hasn't happened since 1961. Could keep going, that's for sure. But the asymmetry, and that's what we do, is we play probabilities and we manage risk by sizing and expression with the put spreads and the tenor and the vintage that we're using and the implied volatility. All these factors go into our decision-making process, and we like the bet. Here, yields getting a short counter-trend bounce. I think those are going to, that will prove to be temporary. And then you've got S&P energy sector now starting to get some legs. We still like Comstock in that space, and we add on weakness. Cooper, and by the way, as always, and the disclaimer will be at the end of the video with exciting music once again, but you can always go to hedgefundtips.com, click on terms. This is opinion, not financial advice. We don't know your financial situation. We deal exclusively with qualified purchasers and accredited investors who have a higher risk tolerance and sophistication. So check with your financial advisor before you do anything, as always. Copper starting to turn up. That is Dr. Copper, has a PhD in economics. I don't know if the air is dry or if it's just from all the flying, but good thing I got the bellhop to bring me a case of water, so we're in good shape. China is now breaking out of its downtrend, as you can see here on the CSI, but more importantly to us is the Hang Seng, which is not in this document, but you can pull it up on, well, I'll pull it up. HSI, which is where all the tech stocks are, and this is huge because it's breaking a big time downtrend line, and we've been waiting for that for a while. So here it goes. Here it peaked up and failed. Here it bounced against it, failed, and now it's broken back out. What can happen from time to time after they peak out like that is they can go back and test it to fake everyone out before taking off. I don't know. I think we've had so many fake outs at this point. It's time to go, ladies and gentlemen. So let's see how that follows through. And want to go through some more market stuff here. This is from Bank of America, Global Quantitative Strategy. The global wave signal is positive for equities and cyclical assets. So this is a key thing we covered last week about global PMIs turning up. So we are intermediate, long-term, super constructive, and fully invested. We did raise a little cash. We did put the tactical hedges on, but we are long as can be. We want to dampen that volatility and create some excess capital if we do, in fact, get that pullback that we discussed with Nicole and also, I believe, Karina. So that's an important thing. This is a very important chart. Dividend yield is relatively inexpensive versus history. Not relatively, actually. I mean, this is where you want to be a buyer. And we keep going back to how much the current environment resembles 2001 to 2003, when small caps were out of favor, emerging markets out of favor, mid caps out of favor, and dividend payers out of favor. Think Stanley Black & Decker, think Comstock Resources, Generac, 3M. A lot of the names we have, there's a reason that we have it. They fall into this bucket, and that's where you can get outsized returns. If going back to Mr. Buffett, the most important quality for an investor is temperament, not intellect. Everyone knows they should buy low and sell high. Why don't they? Because the single greatest edge of an investor can have is long-term orientation and temperament. And intellect is secondary. As a matter of fact, some of the smartest people in the world make some of the worst investors because they simply don't have the temperament or the long-term
orientation. And that's why they hire me. So because that skill set is what made them fortunes in regular business. And the skill set is different. In real business, you get paid for massive action equals massive results. In our business, the less action you take, the more money you make, provided you're buying quality assets when you can get them on sale. Inventory cycle is now back to normal. Half of our portfolio is predicated on this. And when were we buying all these, ladies and gentlemen? You've been with us for 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. You know we were buying all these when they were at peak inventory and now you're seeing them work through and then inflecting. Generac had record free cash flow last quarter, 266 for the quarter. And I think it was 396 for the year. I might have said 366 on the video. I think it was 396. I'll double check that. But anyway, the name of the game is these inventories they've worked through over the last six, seven quarters, whether it's Intel, whether it's Generac, whether it's Stanley Black & Decker, whether it's Canada Goose, you name it, the story is the same. Over inventoried into 2021, 22 when they couldn't get stuff from the supply chain, worked through that. Now they're inflecting. They've got a reorder and the game is back on. Exciting stuff. Korean exports soared. This is a leading indicator for the global economy. Rail and freight volume also jumped. These are all signs of health, ladies and gentlemen. Equity inflows. This is interesting. Large cap is stalling out. Where's the money starting to go? Mid caps and, in a material way, small caps. And I think that's the name of the game. No one sees that. You keep getting these daily fake outs, but you're going to see that they're going to kick in just like they did in 2022, 2002, and so on. The other constructive reason we remain constructive intermediate long term, look at the leverage ratios relative to historic levels. The leverage is still very low. Hedge funds are still positioned very defensively relative to cyclicals. And so on and so forth. So these are factors. You can see the extreme bullishness is not quite there yet on this Bank of America. What do they call this thing? Well, extreme bullishness and extreme bearishness. It's right in the middle. So not yet at an extreme. And the sentiment, we've covered this. It's improving among institutional managers, but it's nowhere near extreme. So this has room to run is the name of the game, even though in the short term it might be getting a little heated. Going by sector, comm services has come down a little bit, so there may be some opportunities, but by and large, most of these are at levels you want to be trimming, not adding, whether it's NASDAQ composite, whether it's consumer discretionary, whether it's financials even, whether it's healthcare. Yeah, that makes sense. Going to consolidate. You know, biotech had a huge move in the last few weeks. That'll consolidate because everyone jumped in after 100. So it's got to pull back and kind of shake out the weak sisters. Even industrials, similar story. Infotech, similar story. Even materials has moved up. What hasn't is basically gold miners, which I have no interest in. They'll probably work, but they can work for you, not for me. Not interested. And the other one is utilities. So there's some opportunity in utilities down here in the hole. And that makes no sense because PPI and CPI missed and rates went up. Why would utilities work? I think it's a short-term counter trend bounce like we saw in the Sloomer documents, and it'll be better. Boy, that Hang Seng looking good. All right. So, you know, PPI, I mean, this number was pretty weak, pretty not good in terms of wanting the Fed to cut 1.6 versus 1.1 estimates. Not good. PPI leads CPI. But the economy is strong. And, you know, there's an article I'm going to refer to where one of the analysts was saying, why do we even need 2% inflation? I think there's something to that. I've made the case for 3 to 4%. For 3 to 5 years, so we can inflate some of the debt away like we did post-World War II. I think that's going to be the playbook again. These PPI numbers are certainly hot.
which could be the catalyst that I've been looking for this pullback, because there's no two ways about it. I mean, you can cut under and say, yeah, food hasn't gone up and owner's equivalent rent starting to come down and et cetera. You know, actually another thing in this is a lot of insurance, which may have peaked as well, but we're not going to know that for another few months, which is why I think it bodes well for this little pullback and why we like that asymmetry around that bet. By the way, I want to thank my generous host for having me out here to London. They will remain anonymous for the time being. I think that's the way they would want it, but you know who you are, and just beautiful setup here. Very grateful for that. Seth Golden talking about labor productivity just jumped to a record high after 15 years of no gains. That is from Bank of America that he's citing, which is a big deal, because when you have increased productivity, you can have wages go up without general inflation going up. And that's what we need from the standpoint of what we're trying to do with the debt, et cetera. Small cap equity positioning is also starting to take off. This is from Deutsche Bank through Seth. We concur. And then from Ryan Dietrich, the S&P is up 17 out of the last 19 weeks. We're working on 18 out of 20, first time since 1964. So look, again, no gains here for 2 years, breaking out of a quote unquote cup and handle. This should continue. This will go, you know, measured move from 36 to 48. So 1200 above that is 6000. But I don't think it's going to go nonstop stair step. What would be potentially natural is to go back and correct to where you broke out, which would be around 4,800 before you take that move up to 6,000. That would be textbook and a beautiful situation. And given the amount of sentiment and all the people I knew who were bearish for the last year and a half when we were on this podcast pounding the table to be buying everything under the sun, are now bulls, and that usually doesn't bode well in the short term. This is interesting. What is the next mystery Warren Buffett stock? This is from Morningstar, Carol Hodorowitz. SEC granted Warren Buffett confidentiality on his fourth quarter 13F, sparking curiosity among financial media outlets what the mystery stock purchase or purchases could be. Regulator is usually willing to make the concession for new stock purchases by large portfolio managers when such action is necessary or appropriate in the public interest and for the protection of investors to maintain fair and orderly markets. So these are their speculations. They have seven: JP Morgan, which I don't think he's going to buy up. Citi, he already owns. PayPal is their third speculation. So we're going to listen to why they think that. Visa and MasterCard, I believe he has some. Bank of America, he has some. And Chubb, why would he chase that up? I mean, that has just run, and price hardening, in my view, is at or near its peak. So to my friends who own insurance brokerage businesses and you haven't sold them yet and gotten rich, shame on you. Get on it, because the window's not going to be open forever. And by the way, when you cash out and take your 50 or 100, I'm more than willing to and happy to manage 5 or 10 for you. So, all right, PayPal Holdings, you know who you are. PayPal Holdings, okay, so Gregory says, this company is large enough to provide liquidity and would be an interesting pick from the technology side of things, especially as meaningfully undervalued on a PE to fair value. PayPal was spun off from the eBay in 2015. Company has 426 million active accounts. Company also owns Venmo. Okay, great. So, all right, moving along to the next thing here. All right, we're making some good time. This is the inventory cycle. We covered that there. Insurance prices soared last month. Why they might finally be peaking. I think that's, you know, and that's the one of the last things to peak, because basically you get asset price inflation and then the premiums go up to cover the new values of those, that asset price appreciation. And then they start to soften. And just as much as, you know, the interesting thing about the insurance business is a lot of people have had this amazing run because even without new units, i.e. new customers, their books of business have doubled in a very short period of time because premiums have doubled. And that doesn't always last. I mean, I remember coming out of the great financial crisis, I was looking with my first boss to buy an insurance company and kind of do a Berkshire type of roll up. And I would go to these analyst meetings at the New York Society of Security Analysts, and, you know, in 2010, and they'd say, you know, price hardening is coming, 2011, price hardening is coming, 2012. And it literally took like 8 years for prices to harden, like they were just in the hole. So it's amazing how short term the memory is. And then not only do you have price hardening where premiums have doubled and you're getting paid double for the same or less work, the multiples that acquirers in these in insurance brokerage rollups are willing to pay have never been higher. And that, you know, the temptation is to think, well, it's only going to get better. And if you're a student of history, you know that if you hit that window, you can go back and buy your business in 5 years at 20 cents on the dollar and do it all over again. So, all right, we're on to the next article of the week, Predators Ball, Stock Market and Sentiment Results. I wrote this a day early because I had an overnight flight last night. Covered that. So 2 weeks ago, we did a comprehensive follow-up on our advanced auto partners position. We talked about it in the 50s on Fox Business, making money with Charles Payne on November 15th. Last week, we talked about it again on the Claim and Countdown. And on Monday, Wall Street Journal broke a story that Dan Loeb's Third Point had accumulated a large activist stake in advanced auto parts and gained three seats on the board. The stock jumped yet again, which is really exciting because they're just going to push them harder to make the changes quicker. Now, they've got Shane O'Kelly in from HD Supply, ran a $7 billion business, knows how to simplify the supply chain, distribution centers, cut costs. As I said on Liz's thing, he cut $150 million before he even found the coffee machine. And he knows what he's doing. So, but now the kind of gun is to the head to implement what he said he was going to do, which he is doing. And it's always good to have some people doing that. Now you might say, wow, that was lucky, Tom. But I would not attribute it to luck for two reasons. Number one, the move in advance, in our opinion, has barely begun. Let's take a look again, zoom out, as this thing reverts back to normal. The upside is significant. Yes, we were interested in the 50s and even the 60s, but this thing is down from $230. So, you know, this can be even a double from here over the next few years and a lot more from where we purchased. So, so that's just beginning. And as with most positions for us, these have multi-year time horizons. The exception is when we hit intrinsic value well ahead of target, in less than a year, like several names last year, Rolls-Royce, we bought at a buck and change. We sold out a bunch at three and change, and then two-thirds, and then we actually just closed out our last one-third at around $5. And the reason is, you know, and if you look at the long-term chart, you would say, well, this looks like it has a lot more upside. And it certainly may. You know, but 400% is a lot, and in a short period of time. Number one, number two, the problem is they have increased the share count 400%. So what you have is a situation right now that it's effectively trading at like $25 and change, well above its all-time highs when everything was going perfect, and everything's not going perfect yet. There's a promise and a trajectory towards perfect, but it's now pricing that in based on fully diluted earnings per share. It's, you know, 20-25% above all-time highs. Now, they've got small nuclear reactors, which is a story 10 year out, very interesting. Airline servicing miles just starting to reaccelerate, but a lot of that is priced in. Doesn't mean it won't keep going, but what you would need to see to have confidence it could go back to 10 from here would be a meaningful amount of aggressive, unprecedented share buybacks to bring that share count down to a level that it was here, which means, you know, they have to take in 75-80% of the stock, which requires a lot of free cash flow
And while they have turned the corner on that, it's not enough to buy in 75 to 80% of the float. And for that reason, we took our money and ran with beautiful profits and a smile so wide you could eat a banana sideways. Moving on. Rolls-Royce. Intel, okay, 25 and change, went straight up to 48. And the last year, we took off two-thirds. We still own a third. We'll probably own that for the long term. The reason we took that off is because the legacy business, which was predictable for us, the data center and the PC business, was fully priced around 50. And we were willing to take a flyer on the house's money on Gelsinger's promise of the future that he can make GPUs in line with what NVIDIA does. And he had all this money from the government, which now looks iffy. So that free flyer may prove to be ineffective. But I think that if there's anyone I was going to bet to compete, it would be Gelsinger. And he was he cut his teeth with Andy Grove, who basically invented Silicon Valley. So I like that, but I wouldn't want to have the full position on anymore. But I do like playing with the house's money and keeping that third. Vornado was easy. That was a quick double. You take that off. Now it's come almost all the way back down. We're taking a look at it again. We haven't done anything, but that could be interesting. If we get some weakness here and it goes back down to the super low 20s or maybe even the high teens, then we would probably consider reloading. Those are exceptions, not the rule. CPS hit 4X at one point. And we haven't sold a single share. Why? Because it was nowhere near our estimate of intrinsic value when we initially entered the position around $5 and change. That one may take several years for us to hit our intrinsic value targets, which are many multiples of where we are today. And we get there by their peak earnings power of $7.10 a share in 2017 and 18. They traded at a 20 times multiple up to 146. Even if you get a 10 times multiple, you're looking at a $70 share. And we think they can do that $7 with 85% of the industry volumes, auto volumes that they had in 2017, because they've taken so many costs out of the business and they're selling more parts per car and their technology has improved and their operations have improved. So we like that story. So number two, here's the second reason it wasn't lucky. This sounds like a Dave Letterman top 10 list, but good things happen when you buy high quality assets at low prices. Let me repeat that. Good things happen when you buy high quality assets at low prices. If you learn nothing else from me, that is the number one lesson. Not only did activist Dan Loeb come into Advanced Auto Parts after us, but it has happened over and over in the last couple of years. In Disney, Peltz's second entry into Disney and ValueX entry into Disney came after us. VF Corp, Engaged Capital, and Legion Partners activists came in after us. Crown Castle, Paul Singer, and Elliott Management came in after us. Four positions out of a very concentrated portfolio, 8 to 12 companies, had a billionaire activist see what we saw, that namely, price is what you pay, value is what you get, and enter the same companies after us. Success leaves clues, and these folks didn't become wealthy doing zero-day options or analyzing squiggly lines to get a perceived edge. They did the work just like we do and just like we share with you. The only difference they bring to the table is they can tilt the scales faster to turn the short-term emotional voting machine of irrationally low-priced assets into the long-term fundamental weighing machine of fairly or fully valued price by agitating management to make changes more expeditiously through public pressure. We get the benefit of riding their coattails while they use their clients' money to pay Wilkie Farr $2,000 an hour to draft threatening letters to the board and foment change. This is not dissimilar to the Predators Ball days of the 1980s with Michael Milken. The only difference is in the 1980s, activists got the whole company. Now they just get a few board seats. So how did that happen? This was an annual convention held by Drexel Burnham Lambert.
for matching high-risk companies searching for financing with investors who wanted the high rewards that can come with higher risk. So Milken came up with this narrative, which is actually correct. And he changed the thinking of portfolio managers from, you know, large insurance companies, et cetera. And he basically said, listen, you're all very conservative with your insurance portfolios and you all own all of this investment grade paper, call it at 4% with a next to nothing default rate. I'm going to sell you a bunch of paper that has a 12% yield with a 10% default rate. And if you do the math, your net after risk return is going to be significantly higher. And once he sold all the portfolio managers on that thesis that yes, 10 or 15% would go broke, but it's safer in terms of reward for risk after the defaults because the returns are so high, that all of these conservative managers said, great, you create the paper, we'll buy it from you. We like more returns for the same or less net risk. And all of a sudden he created, now he had to find his actors to go out on the chessboard. And those were named, Carl Icahn, Steve Wynn, Nelson Peltz. These guys were nobody before Michael Milken. I mean, maybe they, you know, they were not household names. Let's just put it that way. Milken raised billions of dollars and these guys would go out and take over household name companies. They'd go after Nabisco. They'd go after, you know, American Can in the case of Nelson Peltz, Steve Wynn. You know, Las Vegas was built on these junk bonds. So he made a lot of people rich, whether it was Carl Icahn, Nelson Peltz, Ron Perlman, Steve Wynn, Henry Craven, T. Boone Pickens, Reginald Lewis, and many more. But the problem is he upset the apple cart. And he pissed off a lot of people and the powers that be, and they figured out a way to put Milken in jail, and they did that, and he spent 2 years in jail. And in the interim, Marty Lipton came up with this concept called the poison pill, because his thesis was the activism fomented a short-term mindset for the activists to come in, threaten the board to take over the company, and fire everyone, and he didn't think that was good for the company. He wanted the companies to be able to make longer-term investment decisions and sometimes sacrifice short-term profit. And so he basically came out with this unlimited convertible preferred. So if the activists wanted to come in and take out all the shares, the board could just issue and dilute the hell out of their position and dilute them into oblivion so they'd have no control. And then once that happened, then the activists had to be more constructive with boards and start to present ideas how to improve the company, eventually getting board seats on the company. And it's a balance because in some ways, when they could take out the whole company, it kept people on their toes, but it did foster an era of short-termism. But on the long term, you know, the inability or the ability of management and boards to just pay themselves massive amounts of money without performance and not be accountable to the real owners and the real capital. So the truth is the best solution is somewhere in the middle. I don't think we'll ever get to it because he basically changed the world with his poison pill. But even today, you do see activists take a more constructive stance and initiate change more quickly for boards and management that have been sitting on their laurels with owners' capital and not generating returns. So that's where we are today. 3M, great news, three bits of great news. So we had the updates here in January on earnings and November 30th. Three things have happened. Number one, the new CEO, came from Bill Brown, came from L3 Harris. He was the CEO of Harris for many years. I don't have a chart because they tied up with it's now called L3 Harris. It used to be called
Anyway, so it's LHX now. The two companies merged, so you can't see the Harris. But the bottom line is he was the CEO during the period of 2010 to 2019 where defense stocks just went parabolic. He was the CEO, and then he put this together with L3 Harris, and that was a successful integration. And now he's coming to 3M, and he has a history of 5% of sales invested in R&D, and 3M is a company with a legacy of efficacious R&D, which has fallen by the wayside in the last few years because they've been distracted by the lawsuit. So I think he's going to bring a fresh set of eyes. The market likes it. We like it. Everyone likes it. The healthcare spin is taking place, which is phenomenal. That's going to be called Solventum. I don't know. You know, they probably paid some schmuck $1 million for that name. I mean, you can't make this up. But historically, if you read Joel Greenblatt's book, it's the yellow book. Just put Greenblatt into Amazon and the one with the yellow cover. It's not the one that beats the market. It's You Can Be a Stock Market Genius, I think it is. And it talks about how spinoffs outperform because the incentives are aligned and you can get a multiple re-rating on certain portions of the business and it cleans up the balance sheets and you can raise more capital in separate entities and you have a separate board, separate accountability, separate management, etc. So we're going to keep this when we get the spun shares. We're going to keep, because we own 3M, we're going to keep Solventum. And we'll monitor it, but in the first 24 months, the spin tends to outperform the parent. In this case, I think they're both going to perform quite well because a lot of the headaches are in the rearview mirror, and you can see the businesses that they're in there and their pro forma income statement from their filing. And then finally, they had an investor day, and they took up guidance for this quarter. You haven't heard that in a while from 3M. So their estimate was 208. They took the range from 205 to 220, which basically implies 208 is 213 or 215, which is really, really good. Sentiment we know is a little stretched. As a matter of fact, I didn't get to see the AAII this morning because I was on the plane. Still extreme. I mean, there's only 21.9% bearish percent. That's not what you want to see if you're bullish because there are no bears, and that's usually where you start to see a pullback. Okay, we are making good time. We're on to the Ask Me Anything questions, with the first one being from Sam R. Asks, hi Tom, got a quick question regarding security analysis. What's this? Oh, this is a new one that I didn't even see. Yeah, that's correct, Sam. Just that's more of a technical question. Okay, Ray asks, relatively new listener to your podcast. I love your show and appreciate the great analysis and insight you provide. What are your thoughts on Under Armour? The founder announced today that he'll return as CEO starting in April 1st. I believe Under Armour could be a great potential turnaround story. Great brand, low leverage, low PE, CEO shakeup, activist investors on deck. 85% below all-time high, 75% below five-year high. What are your thoughts, Ray? You know, it's funny, Ray. I had a similar thought this morning, and I pulled it up. You know, here's the thing. Kevin Plank, when he was focused and he was hungry and he was building the company, there was no CEO like him. I remember my first boss coming back in like 2010, saw him speak, and he's like, this thing is going to be a rocket. I've never seen anyone so dynamic. And it was. And the stock went from whatever, $1.50 at the great financial crisis to $54 in 4 years. So that was a home run. And then he got sidetracked and he got rich and he started buying horses and screwing around with all types of other businesses and being distracted And then finally, they replaced the CEO, and then replaced it, and it was just like a comedy of errors ever since. So I don't know if he's broke enough yet to be hungry and turn this company around and do a part two of what everyone knew he was capable of as one of the best operators in history, turned into one of the worst. I think there is an interesting margin of safety. I don't love the category, but you know, you see great golfer JT wearing this, their stuff. You see it around. It's not dead. It's kind of like a lower end, high quality brand. You know, revenues are growing. Their margins are getting crushed. That's one of the reasons the stock is down. But free cash flow is turning around. So it's like it's almost as if, and he's a smart guy. He's coming around. He's coming back because he wants to rot. You know, have one last run. And he already sees the turn happening before the market does with the free cash flow turning. I think this is worth a flyer. Let me just check the number one thing with all these turnarounds is just solvency. And if you can get comfort that they're not going to go bankrupt and they've got enough cash flow for runway to turn around and they've got a good jockey, which, you know, I want Kevin Plank part one, not Kevin Plank part two in Kevin Plank part three. I don't know which one I'm going to get, but I mean, the stock is down so much that I mean, they got $600 million of debt and they got $1 billion of cash. So that's not an issue. And then they've got free cash flow. I think they're generating a couple hundred million. Yeah, a couple hundred million in the last 12 months. So their previous year was their trough year. And that's probably why he's coming back. He's seeing the turn. He's a smart guy. Yeah, I mean, it's not a great quality business, but you know, revenues are hanging in there. You know, they're down a little bit, but you know, this has been the problem. I mean, 2016 they were doing 4.8 billion. Last 12 months, 5.7. So it's been kind of just a stagnant business. They got to find a growth driver, but at this discount, I mean, it's certainly worth a flyer for sure. I got to do more work on it. I think there's enough risk that I have to do more work on it. But if you're looking to put on a trade and put it on a little size and then do the work and go through it, I think you're there, and I think this is a pretty good thing. The only one I'm not in love with is he put Mohammed Al-Arian on the board. Although, Al-Arian, I think, was, from what I hear, leave aside the investment and always being bearish, and you know, for the last 15 years, the guy's been bearish every single day because he's, you know, bond mentality, that's normal. So leave aside, because he doesn't have to be an investor to be this chairman of Under Armour. And I do believe he was quite a good operator, a business operator. And Bill Gross was the investment mind. And Al-Arian was the business operator that helped build a monster business. So maybe he is a great pick for chairman. He's coming in as chairman. I think you got something here, Ray. Good work. All right. Craig P. Asked me about Pfizer. And Pfizer, I continue to look at and I continue to pass. I think you're going to be okay with this one, Craig. And I think you can build a position. You know, you look here and the problem is that you had a horrible year in 2023. I mean, earnings are down two-thirds. Obviously, you had the peak from the COVID vaccines. That gig is up. But there's some recovery, and they did that big deal with CGen, and they're doing more deals.
I don't think you're going to get hurt. You get paid 6.2% to wait. If it goes down to 20, is it the end of the world? I mean, you're basically getting more than a 10-year treasury in the short term, a lot more in the long term. The 10-year treasury is going to go down to, you know, 3.5 or maybe even as much as 3. So you're getting double the 10-year treasury and you might have double upside. Worst case scenario is you grind sideways for a bunch of years because they don't get any real growth drivers. And let's just take a look at some of their financials here. The reason I haven't pulled the trigger on this is I just couldn't find a catalyst to what's going to turn it around. But you may not have to turn it around. You know, you just collect 6% until they figure it out. And the answer is they're going to buy the growth with all the cash that they have on the balance sheet. But and maybe it's CGen, maybe it's something else. But let's just take a quick look at this one. Yeah, this has been a problem for me too. I mean, the free cash flow is just like collapsing. Hasn't been this bad since 2009, but it recovered very quickly from that in 2009. So maybe this will be another instance of that. Revenues are collapsing here, certainly off of aberrational highs from COVID. So if you kind of take a look at the long-term trend, you just have to have, let's see what they're doing quarterly. Are they starting to recover on the free cash flow quarterly? Yes. So they had the negative. That's what brought them down. And now they're starting to recover. I think you're there. I mean, listen, guys, you guys are you're doing great work here. I think you're okay. Probably better uses of capital, but I don't think you get hurt with that. I think you've got some nice upside and your downside's somewhat protected. If it goes to 20, buy more. You'll have a 9% yield. Let's see if they've grown the dividend. That would be because you're basically... It's not crystal clear where the growth catalyst is going to come from. So let's see if they're a dividend grower or, yeah, they've been growing it. You know, they cut it big in the great financial crisis. They've been growing it ever since. You're at or near peak yields. I like it, Craig. You're on the money. So, all right. Good job on that one. Philippe Andrew, Pinkos, I noticed you occasionally send flowers to Elon Musk, acknowledging him as a great entrepreneur and innovator in your podcast. I'm curious to know at what price you find Tesla stock attractive. Additionally, could you clarify the distinction between hedge fund tips and official hedge fund tips accounts on Instagram? I appreciate your response, and I continue to share your video cast in the hopes of bringing you a new client. Well, thank you very much, Philippe. Andrew Pinkos. All right. Well, look, I admire everything that Elon Musk has done. Candidly, the reason I've never invested and never had a position long or short in Tesla is one, I think he's a genius. And two, I think there is monster key man risk. I've known people that have worked very, very high up at the company. And I worry about the key man risk. I'll leave it at that. I'm not going to elaborate. You've seen different articles, etc. So, at what price would I be willing to take that key man risk? Because I think SpaceX has value, X key man risk. I'm not sure that Tesla does. I think literally without Elon Musk, no one would drive an electric car. And I've said since day one on this podcast, I'm not sure people want electric cars. I think people want Teslas. And I think the market is proving that out with the Fisker bankruptcy and maybe Lucid next. I can't speak to Lucid. I think Fisker was public information. I think sooner or later they all go bankrupt with the exception of Tesla and the big four to the extent they want to make electric cars. And the Chinese are just crushing it with BYD and everything else. So Tesla, I mean, is there a level? I thought about it the last time they came down to 100. I think I even stuck in an order at $80. It didn't get hit. I think it might have actually hit $82 intraday, but the order was too big that I guess it didn't pick up on it. But, free cash flow rolling over, revenues going up, margins compressing. Let's see. I mean, the issue is you never want to bet against this guy. The question is, do you want to bet with him? And what additional margin of safety do I need to take key man risk? Because unlike, you know, with Berkshire Hathaway, he's in businesses that it's decentralized management. Dairy Queen's going to be fine. You know, there will be massive pressure to break up Berkshire after Warren Buffett is no longer with us. The family has control interest for the time being, so they will uphold Warren's wishes for a number of years until they don't. And then, you know, Burlington Northern will be spun, and Geico will be spun, and Allegheny will be spun, and Dairy Queen will be spun. And the sum of the parts is greater than the whole, so you're probably okay there. You got to have a somewhat of a conglomerate discount there that will be realized. With Tesla, if you lose Elon Musk, I mean, he's the whole source of the story. He promotes the stock. He keeps it interesting. He keeps attention. He gets the free advertising on Twitter, although it cost him $40 billion to get free advertising. He's the innovation. He's the driver. I think Tesla's not worth much without him. I think SpaceX is probably worth a lot, maybe not what it's trading at in the private markets. So for me to take that level of risk, it has to really get low. And it's not going to get to the level where I would be willing to take the risk. But let's just see what I would need. Yeah, the internet's a little slow. While I'm doing that, I'm going to get to the next question. So thanks for that one, Philippe. Oh, the difference between official hedge fund. So I started a new account on Instagram called Official Hedge Fund Tips. The old account, you know, we automatically post our blog posts, and the Instagram algorithm doesn't like that. So I'm doing a specialized, more personalized account where I do a lot of like videos and like, hey, I'm headed to the airport, I just put out my article, and do more like specialized lifestyle stuff, and people get to know me that way. A little closer to what I do on TikTok at Official Hedge Fund Tips. So yeah, follow me at Official Hedge Fund Tips. That's the new account. We're gonna try to put a little more effort into that and have some fun with it that we won't be doing on the legacy hedgefundtips.com account. So, you know, this is a $500 billion market cap business, Tesla is, and we'll get to that. Well, that does, I'm just dealing with hotel internet here. Zach Peters asks, Medifast looks very undervalued, the stock chart trading like it's going bankrupt, very healthy company, only problem declining revenues, maybe they can turn that around. So this is like a weight loss shake company. We've covered this like six times in the podcast. I don't like this company because I know many of the shorts that were involved in this company many years ago and kind of what their thesis were around it. And I'm not, it'll probably be fine. I don't want to be in this business right now. If you say you got to be in this business right now, I would buy Herbalife at these levels over this stock, hands down. That has durable cash flows. That's a big play on the China recovery, but I don't have to be in either, and therefore I'm you know, that's not a priority for me. So Medifast is just not for me. I'm not saying it's a bad stock and it won't work, but if I had to be in that space, you know, I would choose Herbalife over Medifast, but I don't have to be in that space, so I'm not interested in any size of any magnitude at the moment. But you'll also see some insider buying on our preference there. But again, I think there are higher and better uses at the moment. So you got $130 billion of revenue. So it's trading at 5x revenues, 36x earnings. I mean, yeah, I think somewhere around 100, you could take a punt on it. And a lot of Chinese competition, so they've got to get the other stuff. The automated driving doesn't seem to be around the corner. They've got a great data business. The robot promise, we'll see. The flying speed car, I don't know anyone who needs to fly. in their automobile. But if you can bet on a guy who has nine lives like a cat, I mean, that guy was so close to bankruptcy, it was mind-boggling, and the government bailed him out, and he figured out how to play that game, similar to how Gelsinger has figured out how to get government money, which I, you know, I admire that what they've figured out. If you can't, you know, can't beat them, join them. So I wouldn't bet against Musk, and at a price, so 3x revenue with 15% earnings growth. In theory, 15% earnings growth, it may be less than that. 25x forward. Yeah, probably 80 to 100 would be a range. I would definitely maybe take a flyer. And I don't think I could do it in client accounts because I don't have any certainty around it. But I'd probably say on the podcast, like, hey, buy some for your PA and have fun. That said, it's probably not going to happen and it'll bottom sooner than that. But if it does get to those levels, I might be interested. So there's your answer. Till, I know you don't like Japanese stocks, but this one is anyway, global operation. Daikin Industries down on competition fears, but growing nicely as ever. Increasing extreme climate in different regions as a tailwind, cooling in hot places, heating and cold. Any picks in the climate change benefactor department apart from Generac? I guess you can count it to that department. Greetings from Switzerland. So, Till, let's take a look at this Japanese stock, which is called Daikin, D-A-I-K-I-N. All right, so it's down about a third. Okay, let's see what they're doing here. All right, so they've had a problem. They went negative free cash flow the last 3 years. So they're down for a good reason. Revenues are growing. That's fine. It's a low compounder, mid-single digits. Gross margin is collapsing. Price to keep free cash flow is 70x. Balance sheet looks, I guess, okay. Let's see here. Given their cash flow problem and their declining margins, I don't think it's fallen enough yet for me to get interested, but let's just take a look. And I'd really have to understand the turnaround story, and usually turnaround stories, the critical piece is the jockey. Oh, good. This is in US dollar. Great. Okay. Yeah, so revenues have been fine. Problem they're having is their free cash flow was negative last year. So it looks like they're rebounding, but their margins just keep getting hammered. So help me understand why, when their margins are going to bottom out and start to recover. And I'll be a little more interested. Let's take a look at the balance sheet. Probably fine. Japanese companies have a ton of that. $2.5 billion. Yeah, balance sheet's fine. Yeah, so I think, Till, all you got to figure out here is listen to the last 8 conference calls. What did management say they were going to do? What did they actually do? And what is their history of through cycles, and what are they saying is the story to turn around the business?
And then, you know, doing an analysis of the competition as well. Otherwise, this is not going to stop. If margins keep going down and they don't have a clear plan, air conditioning, refrigeration equipment, chemical products. The other thing you have to keep in mind, you know, we have a view which we wouldn't base an equity decision on. But we have a view that the Japanese yen is bottoming, and we've mentioned that a few times on the podcast. So the last thing I want to be is, you know, I want to see what percentage of their sales come from outside the U.S. The last thing I want to do is be a Japanese exporter with an appreciating currency. And that's another reason I don't like Japanese stocks. So, but I think your framework is there. You just have to get convinced that the turnaround is there. And the margins are going to start to reaccelerate. Otherwise, you got cheap for a reason. Some things are cheap, and some things are cheap for a reason, and they're going to stay cheap. And I think right now this is leaning towards the latter camp, but I haven't listened to any of the conference calls, and I'll leave that to you to go through the process. But I think your screen framework is right in the ballpark. All right, this is from JT. Plumbing and heating products. So near an all-time high. Sounds like JT's a momentum trader. I never buy anything up. So right there, it would be out for me. But let's just see if it's a good business. I would hold. You know, this is something I would be a buyer. You know, when it was down 70 something. No, it wasn't. No, it was down like 40%, whatever it was. Anyway, I'd be a buyer there. This looks like it's, my guess is this thing compounds capital at 10%. Yeah, 17%. Revenues are going up. Cash flow looks good. Yeah, its internet's getting slow. Let's see. All right. Yeah, $2 billion of free cash flow. I mean, consistent double-digit compounder. Yeah, so everything is great, except for the fact that it's probably mostly priced in. So, you know, this is a company I would have on my watch list, and if it ever pulled back to like 175, 150, I might be interested. But, you know, the thing is doubled in a couple of years, and it could very well double again. But, I just don't buy up. So I think you found a great company, a high quality business that should be on your list. And when it goes on sale, which it inevitably will at some point, scoop it up. Scoop it up. Manny, got that. Okay, Wilhelm. Oh, Wilhelm Kuberger. What are your thoughts on Victoria's Secret? I prefer Fredericks. Okay, no, bad joke. All right, greetings from Australia. Thanks for your time and effort. This has been such a crap business. You know, I'm going to just bite my tongue on like what I could say about their marketing strategy for the last handful of years. I'll just leave it at that. They finally realized what their legacy target market was, and they've gone back to that. So there may be hope. But they had to go through a restructuring first before they figured that out. And I don't like this business. I mean, declining margins. Let me just see here. Revenues keep declining. I mean, it went from 8 billion down to 6 billion. What's the balance sheet look like? 1.2 billion, 400. Balance sheet seems okay. Free cash flow. All right, so free cash flow was really solid last year. It's declined this year. I mean, I see why you're looking at it, but I don't like this top line, just consistent decline. Gross margin down from 47% to 36%. I mean, sell me the turnaround story and make me believe it, but I don't want to. It's down a lot. You might have a cigar butt here, but this is a business that was crap once before and could be crap again. Wilhelm, I think you got to it for the right reasons, but if you dig a little deeper, you're going to probably just, you know, find better uses of your capital. Bob Johnson, in Buffett's most recent shareholder letter, there was only one mention of Apple, and it was an indirect reference to the size of his Apple holdings. If you judge Buffett's letters based on stock ticker mentions over time, he famously reduced and ultimately exited his position in Wells Fargo in conjunction with a reduction of mentions. Do you think Apple will be the catalyst for the Magnificent Six bubble, which corresponds to 13 years of large cap outperformance, which could be the end of a cycle and further rotation into small caps? You know, it's an astute observation. I don't think it's going to be that binary, Bob. I just think they're going to do less well, and they're going to continue to do well, but less well. And I think the pie is big enough that, you know, it doesn't take much. Small caps, like, is such a small percentage relative to even the size of one of the Magnificent Seven, that it doesn't take a lot of interest in small caps for the index to double and many of the names to be up 5 and 10%, 5 and 10x. I think he did get dramatically overweight Apple, and I think they started to trim, that they may be more materially trimming. I would have been in their shoes, where they started at 200 and change. So kudos to them for taking some off the table. But you never bet against Apple. So I could see them materially reducing the size, but I don't think it's going to be like a bubble bursting, because all these businesses, unlike 2000, are generating massive amounts of free cash flow and have great moats. So I wouldn't make too much of it. We don't own any, and it would need to come down a lot more before we considered buying some. And I think we did some analysis of that a year ago, where it was trading at like 32 times relative to its historic average of 14 times. And the growth rate wasn't that spectacular. It was like 7% a year. So for us, they're higher and better uses. They've got massive re-rating multiple expansion on the basis of incrementally better business performance and with de minimis innovation. So for me, I like things that I can see a double in the next 1 to 3 years, or a multi-bagger in the next 3 to 5 years. And this does not fall into that category at these levels. Maybe it'll get low enough that it will, but for the time being, it is not. So with that said, we'll be back next week. Same time, same different place. We'll be back in the States. We'll see you then. In the meantime, make it a great one. Bye for now.